Good afternoon, everyone. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio at blogtalkradio.com. Happy Wednesday. Happy June. It is June the 1st, 2022. Yeah, this year ain't going too fast. Anywho, welcome to the show. You can listen in via phone, 319-527-6706. As my big sister is doing, and as Sue from New Mexico is doing. You can always come in through the chat room looking for the live button at blogtalkradio.com. That's where Indy Hawk is right now listening in. You can also email me anytime, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. Go into Facebook and type in Hank Jones Poly Sports or Twitter at hpolysports. I don't know how they come up with those names, but that's how they identify me. You can listen to us 7 days a week here at Global Patriot Radio. We're going to start with Sunday this time. Sundays, Eric starts the week off. That's on the international thing. I don't think they do it that way in the U.S. They certainly don't do it that way in my calendar. Eric's in with Real Interfaith Dialogue. And then Mondays at 6 p.m. Eastern, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al. Tuesdays, Eric is back with the Cross and Crescent discussion. And then, of course, every Wednesdays here at 5:30 Eastern Time, Hank Jones with Hank Jones Poly Sports. Thursday rolls around, and at 6 o'clock, you can listen to the Sutliffian Report with Paul Sutliff. Fridays at noon Eastern, typically, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday, and then close out the week, depending on how you look at your calendar, close out the week, 10 p.m. to midnight, Minister Usama Dakduk, along with the beautiful Christie, revealing the truth about Islam. I am here at Electric Hankland with my adorable miniature Australian Shepherd who has eaten, and when she eats, she goes down hard for about half an hour to an hour. Then she'll come beckoning it at the door, trying to get in here to get little scratchies and whatnot. So let's get to our obituaries this past week. Last Thursday, Yes drummer Alan White, that's the group Yes, famous for, of course, Roundabout. Alan White passed away after a brief illness at age 72. He had previously played with John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band before he joined Yes after their original drummer Bill Bruford departed. I saw him with Yes in 1979 at Chicago's International Amphitheater. I survived that fire hazard of a building, but I kind of questioned whether or not I would survive the drive home after I drove through a couple rough neighborhoods along the old Highway 5. I would play my favorite Alan White drum segment, which he actually played on a Bell set, but the song is 15-plus minutes long. It's on their Going for the One album. It's called Awaken. It also features one of my very favorite guitar solos from the awesome Steve Howe. He wasn't celebrated to the degree of his contemporaries like Keith Moon or John Bonham. He was really more like the Rolling Stones' as Charlie Watts, in that he was less visible to the fans, but he was very crucial to the makeup of the group. And oh, how this next one hurts.
As far back as I could remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
Yes. Also last Thursday, we heard news of the tragic death while in his sleep of one of my favorite actors, Ray Liotta, at the age of 67. He was on location for a film in the Dominican Republic. Two amazing roles of his stand out. First, as Ray Sinclair, the psycho ex-husband of Melanie Griffith's character, in the Jonathan Demme film Something Wild. If you haven't seen it, great movie. It's on Amazon Prime right now. Being a gangster was, and of course, his most famous role, the one you're hearing right now, is mob associate Henry Hill in Goodfellas.
Even before I first wandered into the cab stand for an after-school job, I knew I wanted to be a part of them. It was there that I knew that I belonged. And to me, it meant being somebody in the neighborhood that
yeah,
was
just listen to that dialogue.
Like anybody else. I mean, they did whatever.
I turned it down, sorry, but it's where he's sort of tolling.
In the summer when they played cards all night, nobody ever called the cops.
Must I forever be a beggar?
Good, good, good.
Well,
good to see you.
Golden dreams will not come true.
Only stats.
Will I go from rags
to Tony Cicero.
My
fate is up to you.
Tony. Tootie ran the cab stand and La Bella Vista Pizzeria and a few other places for his brother Paul, who was the boss over everybody.
From Goodfellas, the beginning, after he is revealed that he always wanted to be a gangster. My favorite role of his. Just an awesome movie. He did a fantastic job. His creepiest role was as detective squad leader Matt Woz Wozniak in the NBC series Shades of Blue. Trust me, episodes 1 and 2 had me thinking that that series was doomed, but it actually lasted 3 or 4 seasons. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but if you got Hulu or NBC On Demand, look for Shades of Blue. The first 2 episodes, it's like, how did this get past the censors? Then again, last Thursday, Depeche Mode keyboarder Andy Fletcher passed away, they say, from natural causes at age 60. He was often considered the glue that held that band together. He was sort of their quasi-manager for a while, and they said he was like the tiebreaker vote in band matters. Friday, we lost Bo Hopkins to complications after a heart attack at age 84, or 82, or maybe 80. It's been all over the place the past couple of days, how old he actually was. The age isn't clear, but his acting roles definitely were. He played the role of the Pharaoh's leader, Joe Young, in 1973's American Graffiti, as well as in the follow-up, appropriately named More American Graffiti. He also had a small role in the 1978 film Midnight Express. He played a sort of like an ambassador or a consulate member when the film's protagonist, Billy Hayes, played by the late Brad Davis, was arrested for drug possession while getting on a plane in Istanbul. My favorite role of his was as John Coop Cooper in later seasons of the Rockford Files, in particular when he reverts back to his outlaw biker days to get vengeance on a gang, biker gang that had brutally raped his sister. Good actor. Saturday, we lost Ronnie Hawkins, longtime member of The Band, at age 87. They were known for many songs, obviously their most known being The Weight, which appeared in the film Easy Rider. And Monday, we lost Jeff Gladney, former NFLer. He spent the 2020 season with the Minnesota Vikings, but he was cut after an arrest for domestic violence. Later acquitted, then he signed a contract with the Arizona Cardinals just this past March. And then today, we got word that PGA golfer, 3-time winner on the tour, Bart Bryant, passed away at 59 after a car accident yesterday. Among his wins was a 6-shot victory over Tiger Woods in the 2005 PGA Championship. Details, like location, haven't been released. And that's it for the obits this week. Rest in peace, friends. Before we get to the news, my quick shout-out for my friends at Alliance Communications Center in Central Florida, 24-hour call center and messaging service. They serve all over the country, internationally even, a range of call center services. And if you do remote work, think about them as an employer. You can work anywhere with them as long as you have an internet connection, a strong internet connection, typing skills, and you have decent perception and intelligence, they're a great company to work for. Give them a call at 800-555-3738 or check them out online, www.alliancecommunications.com. Okay, folks, this was going to be an A to Z day. I looked up, I pulled 26 stories. And, of course, that wasn't enough, so I did a few others. I got here are my quickies for today. The Department of Justice is reviewing law enforcement's response to the Uvalde, Texas shooting. And now it turns out that the school and the police department are not cooperating with the Texas state review. Odd. And then we had a boating accident in Georgia this weekend that left, I think, five people dead. And then Celtics will be taking on the Warriors in the NBA Finals. That one, this game seven of the Celtics Heat game, the Heat had hit a three-pointer to pull within, I think, 2 points. It got taken off the board. Turns out that the guy had stepped out of bounds before hitting the shot, so went that. And then Paul Pelosi, otherwise known as Mr. Nasty Pelosi, gets a DUI as a misdemeanor with no blood alcohol content listed, of course. And we got Michigan, University of Michigan, cheating in the Big Ten baseball tourney versus the Hawkeyes. A pitcher was using an illegal substance or something in his glove. Then, of course, we got an 18-year-old and a 10-year-old arrested in two separate threats to engage in school shootings. And we got a Blacksit in the White House. Evidently, a lot of Black staffers have left or are leaving. Who knows what that's about, although I can kind of guess. And then here's some good news. John Hinckley Jr., the man who attempted to assassinate President Reagan, he's been granted full freedom. Yeah, I'm sure Jodie Foster's feeling real good about that. And finally, on our quickies, with the 2020 election, as the scrutiny does continue, a newly identified anomaly in Maricopa County, Arizona. If you'll remember, about 6 months back or so, I interviewed a Karma Girl, who was part of that recount, the audit in Arizona. It turns out Arizona law requires it to be considered valid. Ballots must be received by the county no later than 7 p.m. on election day. But newly uncovered records showed that more than 20,000 ballots were transported from the U.S. Postal Service after election day, and they only rejected 934 late ballots. Yeah, more than 19,000 late ballots. And Dopey Joe supposedly took that state by 10,457 votes. Do that math. So isn't that wonderful news? And they're still saying, just put it out of your mind. There was no election fraud. Yes, there was, folks. Okay, let's get to our 26 items for today. From the Daily Wire, Ricky Gervais, British comic, he went on a little, and he did a routine. He went on a bit of a rant that basically he went after transgender folks. He talks about, the interesting thing is, he likes the new women, with beards and cranks. Let's put it that way. And he went on and talking about, he raped her, he raped her. And he's like, no, the proper pronoun is she raped her. Very funny. It's got the left. It's got big left up in arms, of course. Remember Dave Chappelle, who has also gone after trans folks. Remember he told the joke that his attacker had a gun that identified as a knife. Yeah. So, you can imagine how these folks are going to feel about Ricky Gervais's thing. So look it up, Ricky Gervais, TG rant. The Uvalde, Texas mayor is irate at Beto O'Rourke. Last week, Beto O'Rourke went into the press conference that was being held by the state, by the governor. And he just went off on him, said, there's no place for this. You're grandstanding. You're offering nothing. This is a sad report, and families are trying to get closure here and trying to get information. And you're coming in here to rush the podium and scream and telling us we're not doing anything. And even legacy media has said that this thing was clearly staged, a couple different ones. Let's get to who those are. Well, let's see. The main ones have been, by the way, Beto's real name is Francis, I believe, Beto O'Rourke. So CBS News, they suggested that he likely staged his surprise appearance at Governor Greg Abbott's press conference, wanting to confront the governor. By the way, I believe Beto is running for governor. He came in 15 or 20 minutes after the event began to avoid security and the people on stage. Reporter said it was clearly staged. He also had his own people there, media folks. And, yeah, so isn't that nice? Parents are grieving the loss of life. And Beto O'Rourke decides it's a good time to go in and scream at people. Okay, and last on that, Jason Whitlock from Outkick.com had a fantastic op-ed commentary on it. It's titled, Barack Obama, BLM, and the Summer of George Floyd Contributed to the Massacre. He said, as Barack Obama pretends to grieve for the children in Texas, he should make time to recognize that America's emotional and immature reaction to George Floyd contributed to the slaughter of the 19 little kids. He's host of the peer program Fearless with Jason Whitlock. Here's what he said. Yesterday, Barack Obama wrote and published the dumbest tweet in the history of Twitter. The former president stood George Floyd on the dead bodies of 19 slaughtered children. With this, as we grieve the children of Uvalde today, we should take the time to recognize that 2 years have passed since the murder of George Floyd under the knee of a police officer. His killing stays with us all to this day, especially those who loved him. President Obama wasn't done, said Whitlock. He went on, in the aftermath of his murder, a new generation of activists rose up to channel their anguish into organized action, launching a movement to raise awareness of systemic racism and the need for criminal justice and police reform. The demonization of law enforcement and celebration of criminality, said Whitlock in response, are as intentional as the feminization of American men. Men are being baited to reject their natural masculine instinct. Would the same number of firefighters run into the burning World Trade Center towers in 2022 as in 2001? I'd say the number would be cut in half. 2 decades ago, men were rewarded and celebrated for acts of heroism, acts of masculinity, patriotism. Back then, we still saved our highest praise for the men and women who at least tried to do the right thing. Today, the promoters of immorality share and/or dominate our biggest stages of adulation. Snoop Dogg, crip walking during the Super Bowl halftime show, was portrayed as a sign of progress. Cardi B got a one-on-one interview with presidential candidate Joe Biden. George Floyd is more revered than David Dorn or any other cop. What happened in Uvalde, Texas, is no different from what has been going on in America's major cities in the aftermath of George Floyd. Police officers are reluctant to engage with criminals, and violent crime has skyrocketed because of it. Check that out. Google Jason Whitlock, W-H-I-T-L-O-C-K, and you'll see. The guy nails it, just totally nails it. By the way, Jason Whitlock is black, and, you know, so he's not – he's basically saying that he's not represented by Barack Obama. Item C, San Francisco mayor is boycotting the Pride Parade. Yeah, Mayor London Breed said she would refuse in the city's annual June Pride Month parade unless it's organized to reverse a ban on uniformed police officers. San Francisco Pride, which hosts it, first enacted the ban in 2020, but the following parade was canceled due to pandemic restrictions. According to NBC News, the organizers stated the ban was in place due to safety concerns for marginalized groups within the LGBT community. Officers can only participate wearing department T-shirts instead of uniforms. Mayor Breed, a Democrat, criticized the ban. One of the central planks of the movement for better policing is the demand that the people who serve in uniform better represent the communities they are policing, she said in a statement. We can't say we want more black officers or we want more LGBTQ officers and then treat those officers with disrespect when they actually step up and serve. By the way, that type of ban is also in place in Toronto and Vancouver, after local BLM chapters raised concerns about racial injustice. Item D. Chuckie Schumer postponed gun safety measures, gun safety legislation that was put forth by several, mainly by Republicans. He said he hoped he have to have the Senate vote on gun control proposals following the May 14th shooting at a Tops Friendly Market store in Buffalo and the shooting last week in Uvalde. However, the Senate Majority Leader told Democrats today not to expect votes on gun control anytime soon. Instead, he will rely on colleagues, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, to find a bipartisan solution with Republicans that would have a chance of overcoming a filibuster. Yeah. By the way, it was within his own party, what they call moderate members of his caucus, who expressed frustration with his proposals to reporters. By the way, President Trump addressed Uvalde way better than Obidenama could, ever would. Here's what he said. Former President Barack Obama responded to Tuesday's attack on Robb Elementary School by criticizing the gun lobby and pushing for action on guns now. And our country is paralyzed, not by fear, but by a gun lobby and a political party that have shown no willingness to act in any way that might help prevent those tragedies. Someone pointed out, yeah, I didn't see any Republicans at Robb Elementary hurting children. Biden was no better. As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? Biden asked. When in God's name will we do what we all know in our gut needs to be done? President Trump, however, had this to say on Truth Social, his social network. So hard to think or report about anything else after watching the Texas school massacre, which took place yesterday. Thank you to the great wisdom and bravery of our law enforcement professionals, and condolences to all who are suffering so gravely with the loss of those incredible souls so close to you. No words can express the sorrow and grief of this absolutely horrible event. It is a moment in time which will never be forgotten. In other words, properly, he addressed what's happening in the immediate aftermath of the tragedy, rather than addressing something that had nothing to do with it, namely a gun lobby. As Indy Hawk pointed out last week, there wasn't any talk of defund the police last week. Now, it's reviving, trust me, but item F, Dopey Joe with a little transgender extortion. Biden administration says kindergarten through 12 schools must put boys in girls' bathrooms to get federal lunch money. Yeah. In response to the COVID-19 national school lunch program fed nearly 30 million kids every day in approximately 100,000 public and private schools and care facilities. Now, religious institutions qualify for a waiver exempting them from these requirements. Under the new demand, establishments that accept any federal food funding, including food stamps, must also allow males who claim to be female to access female private spaces, such as showers, bathrooms, and sleeping areas. Such organizations must also follow protocols, such as requiring staff to use inaccurate pronouns, to describe transgender people and allowing male staff to dress as women while on the job. Yeah. Yeah. Can you believe it? I can. What in the hell is wrong with this administration? Seriously, what in the hell? Dopey jokes even dopier, by the way, after Georgia. Remember Georgia passed an election reform law last year that caused, of course, Dopey Joe to look like an idiot condemning it. It prompted the Major League Baseball to pull its All-Star game from Atlanta. Here's why he looks even dopier. So Georgia had its midterm primaries last week. They called it Joe and big media last year called it Jim Crow 2.0. Well, big left's pretty quiet. You want to know why? Well, Georgia's early primary voting turnout blew away tallies from the last few elections. According to the Secretary of State, 8,401 people voted in the state's 2022 midterm election, including almost 800,000 of them in person by the end of early voting last Friday. By the end of early voting in 2020, the number of in-person voters was 326,351. And in pre-pandemic 2018, that number didn't even break 300,000. Now read into that what you will. But Washington Post back then claimed Georgia's new law makes voting harder, not better. Guess what? Not quite. Here's what happened, folks. People understood now that voting makes a difference. Now, this doesn't mean that suddenly Republicans are going to take over the state or anything like that, but it does mean that people are turning out. And they're turning out because they understand that rules have to be followed in order to cast a vote in the state of Georgia. Who'd have thought, huh, that it would increase voter turnout, considering damn near every media outlet in the legacy media told us, no, that would not happen. Item H, the Indiana legislature, congratulations, Indy Hawk. Indiana legislature overrode a veto from Republican Governor Eric Holcomb. He vetoed a bill to protect girls from unfair male competition in sports, and the legislature overrode the veto. Yeah, no executive orders needed. No, let the process run its course. Yeah, Alliance Defending Freedom Senior Counsel Christiana Kiefer said in a statement, "Women and girls deserve to compete on a level playing field. We are grateful to the Indiana legislature for responding to the nationwide threat to fairness in women's sports by overriding Governor Holcomb's misguided veto of HB 1041. While more work must be done to protect Indiana's female athletes in college, overriding this veto is an important step toward ensuring fairness in women's sports. This applies to public schools, charter schools, and teams that compete against them. A student who is deprived of an athletic opportunity or otherwise injured by a violation of the law may bring a civil action against the school. It also allows a student or parent to submit a grievance to a school for violating the law, even if the student is not injured." Governor, in vetoing it, said that the latter provision could lead to inconsistency. Well, veto was overridden 67-28 in their House and 32-15 in the Senate. So, yeah, I'd say Governor bit off more than he could chew there. Candace Owens, item I, Candace Owens has completely just utterly destroyed AOC. AOC, of course, spoke out on school shootings. took about a nanosecond, as somebody pointed out, for liberal types to take aim. So here's what AOC said. She took to Twitter, of course, attacking conservatives, quote, for supporting laws that let children be shot in their schools, elders in grocery stores, worshipers in their houses of faith, survivors by abusers, or anyone in a crowded place. She said, there is no such thing as being pro-life while supporting laws that children be, blah, 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 shot in their schools, etc. Then she says, it's an idolatry of violence, and it must end. Well, as somebody pointed out, the right of the people to keep and bear arms is guaranteed by the Constitution. It's not a license for someone to use a gun to take innocent lives, just like a driver's license isn't permission to use a vehicle to mow down people. So Candace Owens said, name the law that allows that. You won't name it because it doesn't exist. You are a shameless, bought and paid for politician standing on the bodies of dead children to score political points. Of course, AOC tried to bring abortion into it in part of her statement. She's an idiot, of course, so you can't, you know, chalk it up to that. But abortion and gun control have no connection, of course. Item J. Some nut jobs in Washington State decided it was a good idea to deface churches. Far-left anarchists have now taken credit for recent attacks on four different churches, which saw them defaced and vandalized in Washington State. The group attempted to justify their actions by claiming that, quote, patriarchal sex abuse cults, unquote, that carry out, quote, the violence of forced birth. Yeah, it's Puget Sound Anarchists, which is a website that publishes writings from anarchists and anti-authoritarians in the Pacific Northwest, shared an anonymous post declaring a Mormon church, two evangelical churches, and a Catholic church had been given, quote-unquote, facelifts last Sunday morning before services for their, quote, ties to anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers, unquote. The churches, according to the anarchists, are terrified of people exercising bodily autonomy, whether aborting unwanted pregnancies or taking gender-affirming hormones or surgery or fucking whomever we want, because they need the rigid hierarchy of the family as the basic unit of control. Went on to say, we dumped red paint over the entryways and left messages, if abortions aren't safe, then neither are you. Other messages included, abort the church and God loves abortion. We are not appealing to state power for an end to patriarchal violence, but threatening. If abortions aren't safe, then neither are you. What in the hell? In the hell? I want to welcome also Hawkeye Mike to the phone board listening in. Good to have you, sir. Item K, in a bit of a mea culpa, although I gave Golden State Warrior head coach Steve Kerr a pass on his Uvalde rant, I also didn't read the whole thing very closely. And two things jump out. One, calling out Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Really? You mean having both houses of Congress and the executive branch isn't enough to get it done, so you go after the minority leader? Two, I'd almost forgotten how vehement he was in his support for Black Lives Matter and defunding the police. Do you know what that included? It included Steve Kerr helping BLM in their efforts to successfully disarm the school police force in Oakland. So I'll say this unapologetically, without rancor, without regret. Steve Kerr, you are a fraud. Your duplicity and hypocrisy is there for all to see. Too bad you can't be honest enough to either issue your own mea culpa or maybe just keep your damn mouth shut altogether. Okay. Item L. Hey, anyone notice that monkeypox is suddenly off the table? No, not because of the Uvalde shooting. I think I know why. Per an article from American Liberty News, it seems almost all the recent cases in Europe and North America, according to contact tracing, can be attributed to several events that cater to gay and bisexual men. Now, normally this would be a cause celeb for the big left, no? But while shootings do tend to take hold of our news, I would also suggest that some of these events and parties, et cetera, not only involve unprotected sex, but would also include lack of safe hygienic issues or practices. Look, while big left loved the idea of going all in on something like COVID-19, most people would not sit still for any kind of quarantines or lockdowns that are a result of unsafe sex practices. That would include any and all sex folks, heterosexual included. If it were traced to swinger parties, orgies, whatever, I suspect it would meet with similar resistance. Kind of is unfortunate. You know, while it is unfortunate that some 200 people have been affected, even big left can't spin this into shutting down an already fragile, shaky economy that really lies mostly at the feet of politicians and policymakers across the globe. People aren't willing to pay more at the pump for unsafe practices of any kind, while healthy people in dem-led locales are having to put back on their masks or maybe even keep kids out of school, like some areas may end up doing. Then again, maybe we could have those crazies in Washington State go deface more churches as a form of twisted protest. M. Dopey Joe has taken executive action on police reform. Comes on the second anniversary of George Floyd's death. Relatives of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, who was killed as a result of a known warrant, ended the signing ceremony. So yeah, Barack Obama signed an executive warrant and then wrote an executive order and then had Dopey Joe sign it. According to NPR, now this order instructs federal law enforcement agencies, the FBI, to revise their use of force policies. The new minimum standard will allow force, quote, only when no reasonable, effective, safe, and feasible alternative appears to exist, unquote. Also limits the use of no-knock warrants by federal officers and requires them to publicly document when and why they need to use a no-knock warrant and disclose any injuries that may result. The order also directs the Justice Department to create a national law enforcement accountability database to track misconduct claims and disciplinary records of officers. You know, okay, federal hiring departments will be required to consult this database. Due to the executive nature of the order, it can't compel local or state agencies to comply. Instead, his order suggests incentives to encourage changes by local departments, such as adhering to federal standards being a condition of federal grants. As I said before, this guy has the Senate, the House, and the executive branch, and he's got to be writing executive orders. What's that tell you? What it should tell you is that he's using executive orders to push things through that probably some people in his own party wouldn't agree with and wouldn't support. Pennsylvania, despite Dr. Oz declaring victory, that is headed to a recount, the Republican Senate primary in Pennsylvania. Evidently, the Supreme Court is weighing in. I haven't gotten the full details of that part. I just was reporting. This caught my eye, as I said. Margin of less than 0.5% between the two highest vote getters automatically triggers a recount. So it'll be Dr. Oz and hedge fund manager Dave McCormick. Kathy Barnett did not do well in that race. But, you know, hey. So Dr. Oz is declaring Dr. Oz declares a lot of stuff that I don't listen to, so this being one of them. Well, well, well. Looks like the White House, this is item O, looks like the White House and the Department of Justice coordinated efforts to target critics and detractors school board as terrorists by branding them as terrorists. This is from American Action News. Despicable, of course. It basically coordinated a scheme to declare parents terrorists for criticizing the school board. Widespread opposition to mask mandates, critical race theory, as those things threatened to defeat Democrats in Virginia and New Jersey, the White House officials coordinated with a national school board group on a plan to suppress dissent by classifying critics as terrorists. In September 2021, the National School Board Association drew nationwide criticism over a letter asking the Biden White House to consider parents' protests as terrorism and deploy FBI agents to investigate. Among those identified as possible terrorists were a Virginian who criticized school board members for covering up his daughter's rape, parents who were organizing efforts to defeat school board members in elections. Attorney General Merrick Garland testified under oath to Congress that the White House and the Justice Department did not act on the outrageous request. But not only did they act on the letter, an internal investigation by new National School Board Association leadership finds the White House knew about the letter a week before its release and was asked to use it to coordinate efforts to suppress critics. An internal investigation reveals that the leader, a gentleman named Chris Slavin, spoke by phone with White House senior advisor to the president, Mary C. Wall, who had advanced knowledge of the planned letter and its specific contents and interacted with Mr. Slavin regarding the letter during its drafting. Yeah, Merrick Garland testifying before Congress is... you could call that this week's episode of To Tell the Truth. In less than a week, he issued a memorandum to federal law enforcement officials directing federal agencies to act consistent with relief requested in the letter. The day after his issuing of the memorandum, Biden himself called NSBA Board of Directors President Violet Garcia in a 15-minute one-on-one phone call and thanked her for letting him know what was happening at the local level and for Dr. Garcia discussing the letter on television. After the coordination between the NSBA and the White House, FBI agents interrogated at least one mother mentioned in the letter. Wow. It's an insult to parents, of course, and to their kids. But really, I mean, the Attorney General just lying to Congress under oath. Well, then again, with Michael Sussman being acquitted, what's new? Okay, it's being asked, why did the police take so long in the Uvalde, Texas school shooting? Enough, you know, there's, as I said, the feds have stepped in to investigate it. Texas State Safety Agency already come in to investigate it. Guess what? The school board there and the local police department in Uvalde are no longer coordinating with their own state. They are coordinating with the federal investigation, but they're not coordinating with their own state. You believe that? It reportedly took between 40 minutes and a full hour from the time that the gunman first encountered a school district security officer. Now, there's so much that we're hearing. And you hear this with every shooting. We're hearing that, you know, he did interact. We're hearing that he didn't. We're hearing that the door wasn't locked. We're hearing that it was locked. That sort out. But when you hear that the local school board and the local police force are not coordinating with their state agency, but are cooperating with the Fed, that's frightening. Very frightening. Item Q. Well, I guess the Miami Heat aren't too political. I'm glad they went down in Game 7, and not that I love Celtics. Okay, Miami had a moment of silence before one of the games to demand, they interrupted it, hijacked it, demand gun makes. Says, this is from the Western Journal. The Miami Heat took advantage of a moment of silence, the NBA observed Wednesday, in honor of the Uvalde, Texas school shooting victims to promote anti-gun legislation. Stadium announcer, this. The Heat organization, the Boston Celtics, and the NBA family also mourn those who lost their lives in the senseless shooting that took place yesterday at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Our thoughts are with the victims, their families and friends, and the entire Robb Elementary School and Uvalde community, the announcer said. Our hope is that families, friends, co-workers, and loved ones of all those impacted by this tragedy will find the comfort and strength they need as they carry on in honor of those whose lives were lost. Up to this point, sounds pretty innocuous, right? After thanking everyone for joining the NBA and observing the moment of silence, then went with this. The Heat urges you to contact your state senators by calling 202-224-3121 to leave a message demanding their support for common sense gun laws. You can also make change at the ballot box. Visit heat.com to register and let your voice be heard this fall. Now, the Dallas Mavericks also observed a moment of silence for the victims of the shooting. Tonight, we held a moment of silence for those who lost their lives in multiple tragedies in Texas. We play tonight's game for Coach Michael Coyne, who lost his life on Sunday returning home from our game, and the victims of the horrific shooting at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. And, of course, Steve Kerr. When are we going to do something? I'm tired. I'm so tired of getting up here and offering condolences to the devastated families that are out there. I'm so tired. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm tired of moments of silence. Enough. As I said earlier in an earlier item, Steve Kerr helped BLM disarm the school police in Oakland, California. So, yeah, political statements are definitely not a stranger to the NBA. The league is pro-China, for one. They permitted athletes to kneel during the Star-Spangled Banner. They've supported other left-wing causes, including gun control. But really, this is just, I don't know. You know, they're all in with China. They say nothing about human rights abuses in China. When one person did speak up, Daryl Morey, LaJuan James, had the gall to say that there weren't people that are speaking out aren't informed. Yeah, Daryl Morey with two masters, I believe, international relations. But yeah, he doesn't know anything. LaJuan does, though. Coming to. Hey, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go with item R, and then we will finish out. In the meantime, let's have a listen to some Jimi Hendrix.
Robin Zamazan.
Jimi Hendrix Experience with Noel Redding on lead vocal, their bassist, with She's So Fine, dedicated to AOC for being so fine in the head. God. We're back. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here at Global Patriot Radio on blogtalkradio.com. Going through the 26 things, A to Z, that jumped out at me this last week. Came up with more, so I added some on the quickies on the front end, of course, and I'll have some stuff on the back end. If you want to interact with us, of course, email me at hjpsports1980@gmail.com. Check me out at Facebook, Hank Jones Poly Sports. Check out on Twitter, where I interact more than I ever do on Facebook. At, or of course, during the show, every Wednesday, you can call in. You can call in on any day on any of our shows at 319-527-6706. That was not an explosion. That was me. I have a file drawer in my office that wasn't closing properly, so I had to sort of force it. But things are cool here in electric Hankland. Okay, item R. John Gruden gets a win over the NFL in court. He's suing the NFL. Former Las Vegas coach John Gruden scored a big win in court against the NFL and Roger Goodell after a judge denied a motion to dismiss Gruden's tortious interference claim. Judge in Nevada ruled that the four Raiders' just two motions could move forward, opening up the possibility of a jury trial in his claim that the league and Commissioner Roger Goodell selectively leaked his emails in 2021. The emails were found during a separate investigation by the league into the then Washington Redskins owner over allegations of workplace misconduct. This led to Gruden resigning shortly after the start of the 2021 season. Judge Nancy Alf refused the league's request to dismiss the case outright and denied the NFL's motion to compel arbitration. Now Gruden's suit will go to trial as a settlement is reached. Following the decision, the NFL issued a statement that it planned to appeal. We believe Coach Gruden's claims should have been compelled to arbitration, and we will file an appeal of the court's determination, the statement from the league read. The court's denial of our motion to dismiss is not a determination on the merits of Coach Gruden's lawsuit, which, as we have said from the outset, lacks a basis in law and fact and proceeds from a false premise. Neither the NFL nor the commissioner leaked Coach Gruden's offensive emails. Gruden was present in the courtroom when the decision was announced, and he said he would let the process take care of itself. He said, it's good to be back in Vegas. I'm going to see some friends tonight. Go Raiders. In November, Gruden filed the suit over emails that contained racially insensitive language, as well as the use of a gay slur and misogynistic language that, quote, was not fit to be repeated in a public courtroom. Time, the former coach's attorney, Adam Hosmer-Henner, claimed that the league leaked emails to harm Gruden's reputation and force him out of his job because the NFL was in possession of them months before the season started. There is no explanation or justification for why Gruden's emails were the only ones made public out of the 650,000 emails collected, or for why the emails were held for months before being released in the middle of the Raiders' season. He worked as an analyst for ESPN's Monday Night Football from 2009 to 2017, and it is from his time with the sports network that the emails stem. Yeah. True, his were the only ones released, and it wasn't about his conduct with the team. Because he wasn't with the Redskins at the time. He was with ESPN. He was never with the Redskins, actually, at least not as a coach. Yeah. It's kind of hard. I mean, it's not hard to believe. But it's kind of really just makes you wonder about a league and a commissioner that would take that stance, that would leak emails that had nothing to do with their initial investigation, and his are the only ones that got leaked. What else was in there? And will the league give those up? I'd guess no, unless compelled. And that might be part of John Gruden's lawsuit, actually. That may be coming. Item S. Six people, including a retired federal agent, were in contact with the Buffalo shooter as little as 30 minutes before the attack. It's from American Action News. Authorities now investigating a new lead in Buffalo supermarket mass shooting, which left 10 people dead, involving a retired federal agent who allegedly was in regular contact with the shooter up until the time of the gruesome attack. Said these were like-minded people who used this chat group to talk about their shared interests and racial hatred, replacement theory, and a hatred of anyone who is Jewish, a person of color, or not of European ancestry, said one of the two law enforcement officials with close knowledge of the investigation. Be interesting to see how that shakes out. Oh, gosh. At least he's retired. He's not active. You know, because the active ones are so noble, so above board. What next? Well, we found, you know, we already know that the Uvalde shooter had been in contact, although that person was not really responding. Looks like another whopper here from Dopey Joe. He got caught lying in his Naval Academy graduation speech, looks like. Now, while speaking to U.S. Naval Academy graduates at a weekend commencement ceremony, Commander-in-Chief attempted to regale the crowd with a story about whether to serve his country or build on his high school sports achievements. He is fond of saying he dabbled in college athletics at the University of Delaware. I hope he throws better than Barack Obama. However, he told the midshipman he applied for the Naval Academy in 1965 with a letter of recommendation from U.S. Senator J. Caleb Boggs. Part of his speech: I was told the class of 72 is here. I was appointed to the Academy in 1965 by a senator who I was running against in 1972. Never planned it that way. I wasn't old enough to be sworn in. I was only 29 years old when I was running. He was a fine man. His name is J. Caleb Boggs. I didn't come to the Academy because I wanted to be a football star. You had a guy named Roger Staubach and Joe Bellino here, so I went to Delaware. Now, in 1965, he would have been graduating from the University of Delaware. Doesn't offer graduate courses. Moreover, he received 5 deferments from the draft, raising doubts about his commitment to serve. By the time he left the University of Delaware, President Lyndon Johnson had already accepted General Westmoreland's request for 44 combat battalions. Of course, Biden pursued a career in politics, like the second he got his law degree from Syracuse. He went on, by the way, but all kidding aside, the best line of the debate was after it's all over, the announcer, the questioner, who was a good guy but supported my opponent, who was a good man as well, I might add, and he said, Senator Boggs, is there anything else you want to say? And he said, yes, just one thing. And he took the microphone. He said, you know, Joe, if you accepted my commission to my appointment to the Academy, he said, you'd still have 1 year and 3 months active duty, and I have no problems right now. It's not clear if Dopey Joe has told the story before, but it did surprise political journalists who have covered his many campaigns and his presidency. 2008 biography, by the way, called Promises to Keep, does not mention the Naval Academy. See, that's why he's so dangerous. Like others in his party, he just lies indiscriminately. He just makes stuff up as he goes along. Think about this now. We talked about gun control. think about in the U.S. Senate right now, we're talking about expanded background checks and red flag laws. Now, think about this, though. This committee, I mean, there are basically 10 people on a committee that are discussing our Second Amendment rights. 10 people. Think about that for a second. Now, we're not talking about, you know, simple laws. We're talking about a constitutional, an element of a constitution, the from the Bill of Rights. And there are 10 people on a committee. You know, that's kind of scary. Now, they're talking about an assault weapons ban. Here's the problem with an assault weapons ban. I'm not against certain banning certain things, but I'd like them codified and classified and delineated. I mean, to just simply say assault weapons ban, what they call an assault weapon, I mean, Biden is now, Dopey Joe is now saying that we need to get rid of 9mm. He says it'll blow your lung out of your body. Nothing could be further from the truth, but they just make up what they want to classify as an assault weapon. They also conflate semi-automatic weapons as automatic weapons, fully automatic. I love that one because when they say, you know, you can get conversion kits, no, you can't. Put it this way, to make a semi-auto an auto would be the same as, you know, using this analogy, it would be like taking your automatic shift car and replacing it with a manual shift. Or vice versa. I shouldn't really think of it the other way. It would be like taking your manual shift car and making it, converting it to an automatic. Well, to do that, you don't just, I mean, if you've driven either, you'd know, but it's the same principle. There's no easy conversion kit to make a semi-auto automatic. Even with a bump stock, that doesn't make it an automatic. But meanwhile, we've got 10 people that are negotiating this right now as part of this committee. Item V, another blown narrative in Uvalde. It looks like the shooter lingered outside of the school for 12 minutes shooting and then walked in unobstructed. This is just one narrative. In a dramatic reversal of the narrative, a Texas Department of Safety gunman outside the school firing his rifle for about 12 minutes. Previous official versions had said the shooter was confronted in some manner upon entering the school by a school-based officer. But Regional Director for Department of Public Safety, Victor Escalon Jr., said at a news conference last Thursday that the shooter entered the building without opposition. Escalon said that during the 12 minutes between when the shooter crashed a pickup truck near the school and entered the building, the shooter fired upon witnesses. During that time, a 911 call reported a man with a gun. There actually was no ISD officer there, as they've been saying all week that there was. Witnesses told police that the gunman left the truck toting one rifle and a bag. Two people exiting a funeral home across the street were fired upon. After that, the shooter climbed a fence, shot at the school from a parking lot, and eventually entered the school through an unlocked door. Escalon said Thursday that officers were, quote, inside making entry, unquote, and took cover, but also said they don't make entry initially because of the gunfire. They hear gunfire, they take rounds, they move back, they get cover. On Wednesday, Texas DPS Chief Steve McCraw said responding officers engaged the active shooter and continued to keep him pinned down in that location. Wow. 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 Yeah, you're going to hear that, though. It's sort of like the Virginia Tech things come out. The media and people demand that this stuff be investigated at the podium. And that's just not a very intelligent way to do it. And I get it. We have this demand for immediate information. But, you know, sometimes we need to let things come out. We need to let things be investigated before they're reported. The police response team had difficulty breaching a classroom door and needed someone to use a key to open the door. Now, is it, you know, how true is it? Do we know? That's not, I mean, it would be nice to know the actual fact rather than keep hearing changes to the narrative and to the actual events. Sigh. Item W. Shootings we haven't been hearing about. Yeah, we've heard about Chicago over the weekend. Newberry, South Carolina. One teen showed up dead in the night. Three more were found the next day. And then it says police at a loss. Last week, four teenage boys were killed in a usually quiet South Carolina town in less than 24 hours. I've been through Newberry, by the way, sending residents desperately looking for answers. Police said the first teen was shot in rural Newberry around 12:05 early Sunday morning. That would have been, I believe, the 22nd. An outlet in Columbia reported the victim, identified as 16-year-old Mike Kane David, soon died of his wounds. Later Sunday, just before 3 p.m., three more young men, 15-year-old Jasir Robinson, 18-year-old Jaquindon Toland, and 19-year-old Santarius Davis, were gunned down only a block from the scene of the first shooting. Police said all four teens lived in the same neighborhood. As of Thursday, police hadn't made any arrests or identified any suspects. Newberry Police Chief Kevin Goodman said the victims knew each other and were, quote, in the same social circle. Chief did not know how close any of them were with one another, nor did he have an idea if the four shootings were related. I'd say probably. Yeah, it's tragic. I would guess it's some sort of gang violence, but still. I mean, you know, we know New York and Chicago and Baltimore and all those places have had the shoot-ups, but Newberry, South Carolina? Trust me. Not exactly a hotbed of, it's not a very high population at all. So, item X. You know, Democrats have a new way to fraudulate elections. I made that word up. A Republican frontrunner has been ruled ineligible for the ballot. Michigan Bureau of Elections dropped a midterm bombshell Tuesday. According to its review, five of the 10 candidates running for governor failed to reach the 15,000 signature threshold to get their names on the ballot. Now, when that happens on the Democrat side, they let them on the ballot with a, hey, hell of a try, hell of a try. Anyway, former Detroit Police Chief James Craig, businessman Perry Johnson were among the most prominent Republican candidates who reportedly failed to submit enough valid signatures. Michigan Board of Canvassers met today to review the Bureau's findings. The board, consists of two Democrats and two Republicans, came to split decisions, possibly dooming Craig's campaign and that of five other candidates. For the time being, at least, none of their names will appear on the August primary ballot. The state will now likely see a very high-profile legal battle. I mean, this is their new way. That's how they'll go after it. They'll go after it on eligibility. Yeah, I know. Democrats going after it on eligibility basis. The last two surveys, according to Real Clear Politics, have Chief Craig leading the GOP primary by about 17 points. In the general, current Governor Gretchen Whitmer has led Craig by about 3 points in hypothetical head-to-head matchups. Oh, by the way, Mayor Kaiser Wilhelm, former Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York City is running for Congress. Item Y. Mitch the Bit McConnell made a rather advised move. He boasted, he went on a media tour, he bragged about defeating opponents of Dopey Joe's foreign policy. Went on a big media tour to praise President Biden's foreign policy, to take credit for a massive additional spending package for Ukraine, and to virulently attack 11 Republican senators and 57 House members who voted against it. He wants to be associated with the Democrats' bill, apparently, and he should be remembered as having helped its passage. In fact, he worked with Democrats to expand the bill from the initial request of $33 billion to $40 billion. We've now spent more than $50 billion total. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri said, spending $40 billion on Ukraine aid, more than three times what all of Europe has spent combined, is not in America's interests. It neglects priorities at home, allows Europe to freeload, shortchanges critical interests abroad, and comes with no meaningful oversight. That's not isolationism, that's nationalism. It's about prioritizing American security and American interests. By the way, the National Review praised passage of the bill. Turns out still nearly one in four Republican senators did not support it. McConnell told Politico, it's a small isolationist group, somewhat encouraged by the former president, but it's not widely held among Republicans in Congress, and I don't think among the public in general. Really? Rand Paul noted, opposing big government spending is not isolationism, it's common sense. Oh, man. Item Z. Go woke, forget to do your job. I know it didn't rhyme. Get woke, go broke. No, it's go woke, forget to do your job. San Francisco Giants manager Gabe Kapler, Gabe Kapler. He did the usual not show up for the national anthem. Please don't let that prevent you from doing your job. Last Friday, Kapler announced he would not take the field for the national anthem because of his political views. So I don't plan on coming out for the anthem going forward until I feel like I feel better about the direction of our country. Okay. He clarified in the subsequent blog post that he took issue with gun industries in America and seemingly advocated for more gun control. He said, we aren't free when politicians decide that the lobbyists and gun industries are more important than our children's freedom to go to school without needing bulletproof backpacks and active shooter drills. Obviously, plenty of issues with his reasoning. Starting with the fact that gun industries didn't pull a trigger. It was a deranged criminal. Flawed logic, of course. Doesn't justify disrespecting the flag, as the article notes. Anyway, he has a right to make himself look foolish, as somebody pointed out, but when he does do his job, so according to NBC Sports, Giants pitcher Jake McGee was activated from the injured list earlier on Friday. Kapler intended to utilize him in the game, and he called on him to enter the game in the bottom of the eighth inning. It was at that point Kapler probably was done in by his obsession with woke grandstanding. When McGee tried to enter the game, the umpires informed Kapler that he had not listed McGee on the roster card. Major League Baseball managers exchange roster cards with each other before each and every game and list all eligible players. That's a basic task each manager is expected to do. But, of course, McGee was not allowed to enter the game because he was not on the roster card. So Kapler had to bring in Jose Alvarez, who two runs en route to a 5-1 loss for the Giants against the worst team in the league, the Cincinnati Reds. Kapler's comment after the game, "We have an extremely detailed and meticulous group. We failed to get McGee on the lineup card, and ultimately that's my responsibility." So Jake was unable to pitch because he wasn't on the lineup card. Subsequently, I had to bring Jose Alvarez into the game. But he was too busy grandstanding instead of doing his job. Item Z in the books. Okay. In today's fake news you can trust is a feature from the Babylon Bee via Patriot Central. This quote, "Guns should not be in the hands of the unstable," said by a senile man who has nukes. For today's real news that shows who you can't trust, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen admits that she made a mistake on inflation forecasting. Wow. Yeah, she actually admitted it, that she was wrong when she called it transitory. Never thinking, of course, that shutting down pipelines and closing off American oil production might lead to increased gas prices, which is one of the first things that leads to great inflation. Seriously. I mean, that would be like the Secretary of Education saying, you know, by not having in-person instruction, we think test scores won't go down at all and that people won't, the students won't miss a step. It's akin to that, but really. Made a mistake on inflation forecasting. Not that really sane people would listen to her anyway. Still, beyond the surreal, Dickie Durbin and the other Dems have a new culprit on which to blame inflation. They're blaming inflation on credit cards. Oh, the irony. Oh, the irony. They are blaming inflation on credit cards, not just on spending, but on the fees. Hey, Vito's in the chat room. I forgot to mention that. Vito's in the chat room. Came in at about 8 minutes ago. So Vito's in there with Indy Hawk. T. Bodie has joined us on the phones. So, anyway, yeah, the Senate Democrats are blaming credit cards for inflation. Think about that for a second. Just think about that. Increased debt and increased fees and interest. So it doesn't occur to them that runaway spending by our government, coupled with things like shutting down oil industries, shutting down economies, that that's not to blame for inflation. They're blaming the credit card industry. I mean, where do we even go with that? How do you even reconcile that kind of logic, that kind of stupid thinking? How do you get there? How do you get there with that one? Credit cards are causing our inflation. But who is the biggest debtor in all this? Our very own government, led by our Senate and House Democrats and our Democrat occupant of the executive branch. It's credit cards. I mean, it was Trump, it was Putin, it was the pandemic. Now it's credit cards. I'm at a loss on that one, folks. I really am. Hey, some good news for Hawkeye sports fans. Chris Murray, twin brother of Keegan Murray, one of the Big Ten players of the year, all conference, player of the year by some folks, player of the year or off candidate for player of the year on the national level and an All-American. His brother, Chris, his twin brother, is coming back to Iowa. He had declared, not for the draft, he had put his name in for draft consideration, did not actually go to the combine and play. I don't know if he would, but he certainly didn't play at the combine. He was projected probably as a second-round draft pick and chose to stay with the Hawkeyes. Now, that's good news in one sense, but in another sense, it's kind of frightening because this is a guy who couldn't play ahead of Patrick McCaffrey or Connor McCaffrey a lot of the time. Remember, after the Hawkeyes lost to the Richmond Spiders in the first round of the NCAA tournament, Fran McCaffrey glowed about his son Patrick and how he's going to do so much next year. Look, I'm not knocking on Patrick McCaffrey. I'm sure he's playing his best, but as Indy Hawk pointed out in a group text, Chris McCaffrey had to go to the NBA to start ahead, or Chris Murray had to go to the NBA to start ahead of one of the McCaffrey boys, but now he's staying. Hey, we got a call. Welcome, Sue from New Mexico. Sue's calling in. Sue, how you doing?
Hey, hi, I'm doing fine. You know, I just wanted to see if maybe on your next show, is it Indy Hawk who talks about the Supreme Court and rulings?
That's Mike. That's Hawkeye Mike.
Oh, yeah, Hawkeye Mike. Anyway, if he could come, you know, the SCOTUS ruling is pretty fascinating, and I think it's a very important ruling. Actually, what it was and what was written down there, of course, McCormick, he wanted all of the mail-in ballots to be counted. And what SCOTUS halted it was that the mail-in ballots that did not meet state law could not be counted. And in the ruling, it was really interesting. They said because once a winner is declared, it's too late. And so this can have really big implications coming in the November elections and beyond. It looks like maybe they're, you know, going to step in on this one. And where the controversy was, state law says that on the outside envelope, the name, they have to sign their name, and then the date that it was mailed in, they have to put that on the envelope. And evidently, I don't know, there was 900 or so ballot that didn't meet that requirement. They're saying on the inside of the ballot, once it was separated from the envelopes, that there was a date written in, but it didn't specifically meet state law. And so I kind of like someone who knows a little bit more about this, if they could go into it, because when I read that, I thought, wow, this can have real implications for, you know, the November elections and beyond. You know, if SCOTUS is going to come down now and say you have to follow state law, and if they're not looking at it now as, whoops, we made a big mistake. But, of course, in the last presidential election, nobody knew until afterwards, you know, what had really gone on.
Yeah. Well, I remember Karma Girl, when she was on, she talked about, I mean, now we know that they brought in the late ballots in Arizona, but we also heard, you know, from her before about the quality and the difference in ballot types, you know, card stock, completely unfolded absentee ballots. And now we're hearing that they brought in, you know, over 20,000 late ballots. I mean, some of them were disqualified, but over 20,000 late ballots, that's huge. And you know, I'm not sure. I just texted Mike, so I'm going to bring him in. Let me bring him in.
Oh, Gravy's there. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because, yeah. You know, I don't
Mike,
understand all this, but I think it's interesting, and I think it has implications.
Yeah, I'm here, I think.
Mike, did you hear what Sue asked?
Yeah, I did. I was listening, and glad you remembered me, Sue. But I think what she's getting at is she kind of summed it up pretty good. What happened was I believe Justice Alito, who each of the Supreme Court justices covers a specific area of the country when they get, like, petitions to hear on an emergency basis. He granted a stay of sorts, kind of, sort of, in the case to prevent certification of a winner until potentially they could hear the case. And what's at stake here, she summed up, was that apparently there's a law in Pennsylvania that says mail-in ballots have to be dated, signed and dated, and if they aren't, they don't get to count. And apparently what the McCormick campaign is trying to do is get, I don't know exactly how many, several thousand, I believe, ballots counted that didn't have dates. And so they went to court and said, you know, they should be counted. There's, I believe, a parallel case going on in state court about this too.
Okay.
I don't know how this is going to pan out, but I do know that under Pennsylvania law, they have to certify a winner. They have to complete the recount that was going on. That I believe is still actually going on.
Right.
There's just a question of whether or not these ballots that are unsigned should be, undated should be counted. But that has to be done by, I believe, a week from today, June 8th.
Okay.
So I don't think that June 8th deadline is going to be affected by the stay by Justice Alito. And I don't want to, you know, the bottom line on these things is that, well, this could potentially tip things if you've got thousands of mail-in ballots, which I believe favored McCormick during the election count.
Okay.
He had a lot of he did better on that, and odds did better on the same day vote.
Okay.
So McCormick's thinking that, you know, if I can get this batch in, he's about 900 votes behind out of almost a million votes, which, you know, that's about as close as you can get. It's like,
yeah,
Florida,
absolutely.
2000 almost. But anyway, if he's thinking that this could be an advantage, and it's possible. He's looking for extra votes, but, you know, the bottom line, even with a margin of 900 votes, my guess would be that you're probably not going to overturn the Oz victory on a pure recount. So he needs to come up with a way to get some other votes counted. I think my guess is, after what happened in 2020, that at the end of the day, the courts, both state and federal, are going to go with the law as written by Pennsylvania and not count these ballots. But anyway, that's what's going on right now. I think that, I think the bottom line is that the recount's probably going to confirm that Oz won. And I don't think these votes are going to come in, but we'll have to wait and see. They do have this deadline though of June 8th, a week from today. So I do think that, you know, I mean, at some point this starts to hurt the Republicans if this thing just drags on, and the Democrats have their nominee. It's a seat, it's an important seat, as they all are, but particularly important that Republicans hold this seat. So, you know, I kind of felt like I didn't, you know, I have some issues with Oz, but I don't know about if McCormick's any better. I think both of them can win. But we need to get this resolved and pick a nominee and you know, move on to November. So I think Sue's right on that, about how this can affect things for the general election in November if they don't get this, you know, if this thing just completely drags on. I don't think that will happen, but anyway, that's kind of where we're at right now.
Okay.
Well, Mike, You know, the thing that I was saying, not so much about who wins between Oz and McCormick, but what I'm saying is in November 2022, they're going to try to bring in all of these mail-in ballots. I know in, say, Georgia, for example, they still have 17 drop boxes. Is the court signaling that they will step in early, you know, in all the states if state law is not followed? Because that was the whole thing with this, is you have to follow your state law. It's not so much about who will win, but state law.
No, that's a great point, Sue, and I think you're absolutely right. The Democrats in particular are going to pull whatever stunts they can in what's shaping up to be probably a disastrous November election for them. And so they're going to want to try to, you know, this is what happened in 2020 that caused so much damage, where they brought in all these, in many instances, in contravention of the state law, the governors, some of these states were Democrats, just decided they were going to, because of the COVID emergency, and they may try to do it again here or use some other reason, brought in, you know, just massive mail-in ballots, and then the drop boxes that went with them combined with what's called vote harvesting to just basically bring in thousands of pro-Democrat votes. And these both the drop boxes and the ballot harvesting are ripe for fraud. Now, after the election, some of the legislatures, including Georgia and I believe Pennsylvania, passed laws basically saying, hey, you know, that you can't do this anymore. You got to follow the law as written by the states. I think the courts are probably, certainly anything that happens in the Supreme Court, but I think most of the other courts are not going to let that happen again. I mean, you have to keep your eye on this, but I feel pretty good that this kind of stuff, we saw what happened in 2020. They're not going to let them pull this stunt again. And the key thing is that you have to prevent fraud, because once it happens, we saw what happened in 2020, there's not enough time to try to file lawsuits to correct it. It becomes, you know, you get this big imperative about, oh, we got to get this over with and get the winners certified. And there's just not enough time, you know, like with when Biden won. So the key thing is that you have the court step in and basically rule before the November election. I think that that's probably going to, and I think that Republicans have learned this. You got to get the courts to reinforce what the law is before, and I think that's kind of where we're at now. So I'm hopeful that we're not going to see in 2022, although the Democrats may try to do it, but we're not going to see that happen, what happened in 2020. So, you know, yeah, keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully that's not going to be a repeat.
Mike, let me ask a question. You know, we saw, through 2021 and part of 2022, the Democrats were trying to basically take control of the election process from a federal level. And as Dopey Joe said, he said what Democrats think, but they didn't understand it. You know, it's not about who makes the votes; it's about who counts the votes. Which, you know, that Freudian slip. But do you think there is a middle? I don't want to say middle ground. Don't we need to at some point get to some, maybe not a federal control, but some kind of federalized standard? I mean, you know, you have one state that allows, you know, mail-in ballots. Another state requires signatures, and another one requires dates. I mean, do we need to have some kind of standardized, election standard, do you think? Or is that going too far, considering that, you know, it's the difference of states? I mean, a state with, like, Wyoming is different than California.
Well, you know, traditionally for the 200 and almost 50 years the country's been in existence, it has been customary that the states set both the federal and state elections, the rules in each of the states. And So what happened with the Democrats was, because they didn't like what a lot of Republicans were doing in certain key states, because like Pennsylvania, Georgia, the Republicans control the legislatures and stuff. And because they liked the way things happened in 2020, they basically wanted to enshrine what the kind of things that happened in 2020, universal mail-in balloting, and all this kind of stuff, in a federal law. And they can do it probably to the extent that they are affecting, you know, like federal elections for Congress and the president. Of course, probably not. They wouldn't have jurisdiction to do it for state elections for the legislature and state offices. But anyway, they were trying to do that. So the question becomes, they can do it, but you know, they weren't looking to compromise with Republicans on sort of a unitary federal standards to apply to all the states. They wanted to basically continue to game the system in what they thought was their favor, the way that a lot of the things were done in 2020. So, you know, Republicans, if they were going to federalize it, and I haven't seen a lot of support for that among Republicans in Congress.
Right.
But it would be completely different than what the Democrats are trying to do in that voting, quote, voting rights election bill that got filibustered. I guess it's a question of who's right in the law, right? The Democrats aren't going to be – they're not looking for a level playing field and uniform standards so much as to tip the scales as they perceive it in their favor.
Yeah, and I guess I should put it this way. When I say standard, I'm thinking more along the lines of, as an example, really, you know, Democrats hate the Electoral College, of course, right now. They kind of like it right now, but not really. They liked it last November, but you know, I'm thinking like, for instance, like states that split their electoral votes. You know, Maine, I think Nebraska, and other states where they allow them to split up.
Right.
I mean, is that not something that's really covered, you know, constitutionally? I mean, I as part of the Electoral College. I mean, that's those kinds of things. I mean, that changes. I mean, like, what's the phrase I'm thinking of? For equal protection clause. Does that fall under that?
No. So you got a couple things going here. Basically, and there was a ruling recently by the Supreme Court a couple of years ago about whether you know, the states have sort of unfettered rights to decide how electoral votes in their states are cast. And I can't remember, it was kind of a nuanced opinion, but I think the bottom line is that, as has been the case again for 250 years, the states can set the standards. If you remember in 2000 when we had the controversy in Florida, traditionally, you know, each state, the way they've done it is it's winner take all, whoever wins the popular vote in the state. But that's not etched in stone, but that's the way it's been done. You're right, there's two exceptions, I believe, Maine and Nebraska split by congressional district. But the rest of the states still have done it that way. And, yeah, I think that, you know, again, the Democrats would love maybe to have proportional in states that they're barely losing, but do they want a proportional divide of the Electoral College in New York and Illinois and
California?
I doubt it. You know, it kind of cuts both ways. But the argument to do the winner-take-all thing is that you get a decision that way. You know, someone's going to win enough, basically in a two-party race, someone's going to win enough each time to get the electoral votes they needed. But I think actually the Supreme Court was on whether the decision was more on whether the electors are bound to vote the way. In other words, let's say California, the Democrat wins, so all the electoral votes go to the Democrats. What if you get a few electors who decide, well, you know, I'm going to vote the way I want? Can they do that? And I think that's what the case. And I believe the decision pretty much was that they aren't just free agents.
Yeah.
And you know, that usually doesn't happen, because what has been done is whatever party wins a particular state, they have a slate of electors that are usually sort of party hacks.
Right.
Almost a ceremonial thing, and then they go and vote. But every now and then you do get some sort of, you know, rogue elector
yeah.
that decides that they're going to not do it. I think in 2016 when Trump won, there were maybe two Trump states where they didn't vote for Trump, but there were like six or seven Clinton voters, electors that didn't vote for her. So she actually lost a few votes that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think most Democrats would prefer to go with the popular vote because they think that's their advantage. Maybe it would be, but if you eliminated the Electoral College, the way you go out and maximize votes would be completely different. Right now, Republicans don't spend a dime in Illinois, New York, or California, and because they know they're going to lose. And they're also very big states. If you had a popular vote, that you would want to max, even if you didn't win California, it wouldn't matter, but you'd want to maximize your vote in those states to try to overall win the popular vote. It would be a completely different strategy, but I think by and large, to be blunt, the Electoral College does help Republicans probably more. I don't think Bush would have won in 2000 or Trump in 2016 if you had just pure popular vote.
Yeah. Well,
but it would have been done differently, so it's hard to know. You know. That's,
yeah. Exactly. That's, I mean, that's, and that's why I will still maintain. In 2016, Trump played it. You know, remember in Godfather Part Two, Tom Hagen says Roth played this one beautifully. I said that before the election. I said, man, Trump played this one beautifully, because if you'd have asked me in 2015 when he announced, did this guy have a chance, I would have laughed. But man, he did it. I mean, on every level in free media, in how he campaigned. I mean, he was brilliant, his campaign was brilliant. And so, you know, I think it's been pointed out, the Electoral College protects everyone. It doesn't just protect this state or that state. It literally protects everybody, you know, and that's why from a republic versus a democracy, it's the same thing. In a straight democracy, it's always about the majority, and it's never about the individual, you know, and so it's the same thing. I mean, we're getting, unfortunately, we're a bicameral democracy more than we are a republic. But
do we want California and New York deciding who the president is all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Which with the Electoral College, you sort of, you know, it's based, predicated on the belief that the states matter, and that's why we have it. And that goes way back to the Constitution itself. You know, you can make the same argument that the Senate's undemocratic. Why should Rhode Island and California have the same number of senators? Well, as we know, historically, that was a great compromise, right? The House was based on population, so you get a state like California has more congressmen, but the Senate was going to be where you had the evening out, and each of the states, no matter the population, would matter, because we live in a democratic republic. We don't live in a pure democracy.
Exactly. So anyway, well, thanks for coming on, Mike. And Sue, thanks for the question. That was a great question and a great observation. You still there, Sue?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for calling in and listening. So, okay, thank you both. I am gonna I'm gonna mute you out right now, because I just have a couple quick things before I sign off. I know it was a little different tonight. I did the A to Z. I told Vito this is what I was gonna do. I did it for several reasons. One, I get so much stuff that I, you know, news bombardment, but I kind of wanted to just go through some of these in the fashion that I did, because I didn't really want to dwell. I really don't want to dwell on what's happening in Uvalde. I know it's about a Second Amendment, this, and it's about, you know, how are we going to protect our kids? But you know what? That gets tired. And you know what? Pretty much everybody knows where I stand on the Second Amendment, you know, and also where I stand on protecting our schools. I'm not willing to compromise on either. I'm not willing to leave our students vulnerable, and I'm not willing to compromise our Second Amendment rights. So that's kind of why I did it. I wanted to make sure I didn't focus on any one thing. But again, as Sue just readily and thankfully demonstrated, this is also about the listeners. Now, while Sue and Mike were on, I had another call. It was a number I didn't recognize, and Vito and I have talked about this before. You get some of the crazies that call in and want to hear themselves talk or want to say something gross. So, you know, I didn't want to do that, but I didn't want to interrupt Sue and Mike. So that's – but, again, I'm not going to do this every week, so don't worry about that if you are. I will speak on things that are relevant and timely. And, you know, so this, but I just wanted to do this today. One, it was kind of fun to just pull stuff and look. I mean, all those things that I brought up, I read every one of those articles or multiple articles on them. Tells you somebody who's only working a certain type of job now. I'm no longer my own business, so to speak. So I'm not having to deal with all that stuff. I have time to do it. And it was fun to do. But again, it won't be like that every week. So, as I said, a couple of quick notes. As I said, Chris Murray for the Hawkeyes staying. Talk about Bart Bryant again a little bit. You know, it's fleeting, you know. I mean, just like the you know, we talk about a shooting can happen anywhere or anytime and so quickly. So can a car accident. You know, here's a guy, a three-time winner on the tour, beat Tiger by 6 strokes to win the PGA back in 2005. And car accident, he's gone. It's sad, it's tragic, but it's also a reminder that it's all fleeting. You know, we could have every gun law on the books, and somebody who doesn't want to obey gun laws will still shoot up a McDonald's or a parking lot. We can take all the precautions in the world out on the road driving, but you know what, you get a bad driver on the other side of the road, it's a median, and you know, that's it. So, yeah, it's fleeting. There's no guarantee. And that's it for tonight, folks. I have got, believe it or not, I've got an engagement, not a long one, but I've got to do something for my wife. She's out of town. She's still in Ohio. Please be praying for her mother, who is undergoing health challenges. And my son-in-law also underwent a little bit of a health challenge a week ago. And he's mending. Very grateful for that. He's a great young man. I'm very grateful for him and for my daughter that he's on the mend. I did not touch on the quarterback challenge, T. Bodie, because it's not real golf. It's not real golf as far as I'm concerned. I know they're better than me, but it's not the same. Do I really want to watch a 3-point contest between Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson? No, any more than I want to. And even if, you know, if they've got Steph Curry on one side and whoever on the other, I don't care about it. It's entertainment, but it's not real sports. But, you know, I get it. I respect everyone's right to watch. T. Bodie's also in the chat room. He was on the phone, or he's still on the phone, but T. Bodie's in the chat room. I want to remind everyone, Fort Dodge, Iowa, a week from this Saturday, Shellebration. It's their annual big deal fundraiser, and they've got some great acts. And and of course, T. Bodie is one of your main guys there. So go to shellebration.com, I think it is. It might be org, but it's shellebration.com or .org. And check it out. If you're in the Midwest and you got nothing else going on, it's the same thing. You know, you could go to Fort Dodge, go to one of the places, go to the community tap. What the heck? You can watch the Preakness and then catch Shellebration. In the meantime, folks, I'm out. Have a good evening. Have a great rest of the week. Have a great weekend. Be safe, and thank you for being here tonight, folks. I'm going to send you out with Ray Liotta again.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care. And though my pocket may be empty, I'd be a millionaire. My clothes may still be torn
and tatter.
To me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States. Even before I first wandered into the cab stand for an after-school job, I knew I wanted to be a part of them. It was there that I knew that I belonged. And to me, it meant being somebody in a neighborhood that was full of nobodies. They weren't like anybody else. I mean, they did whatever they wanted. They double parked in front of a hydrant and nobody ever gave them a ticket. In the summer when they played cards all night, nobody ever called the cops.
Must I forever be a beggar?
Good, good, good.
These golden
dreams
will not come true.
Only stacks.
Will I go from rags
to... Tony Cicero. Tootie ran the cab stand and La Bella Vista Pizzeria and a few other places for his brother Paul, who was the boss over everybody in the neighborhood.
Hello, Paulie. Hey, Paulie.
Paulie might have moved slow, but it was only because Paulie didn't have to move for anybody.
Must I forever be a beggar?
Your fault. You started. I started.
Hey, the late, great Ray Liotta in his role as Henry Hill in Goodfellas. I want to thank Indy Hawk and T. Bodie and Vito for being in the chat room. Sue for being on the phones and her call. Big Sister as well. And, of course, Hawkeye Mike and T. Bodie and my buddy Jeff that was in earlier. From the area code 337, sorry I didn't get to your call if you're still listening. And if you do want to call in next week, you got something to say, we certainly welcome you back. Have a good night, folks. Be safe out there. God bless. Good night.